We are going to open a subcommittee at this point in time. Some of our members are testifying in other rooms, committees at this point in time. It's a beautiful day in Oregon, and I'm glad to be here. And we're I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2700A. Very excited about this bill. It's been a long time coming. I'd like to call Representative Diane Rosenbaum forward.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I am State Representative Diane Rosenbaum from House District 42 and also Speaker Pro Tem of the Oregon House. And you're right, it is a beautiful day, and it's especially a beautiful day because of the hearing that you're holding on House Bill 2700. So I'm delighted to be here to tell you about it. And as the chair said, it has been a long time that we have been trying to get this legislation passed. In fact, it's been 14 years, and we believe that the time has come and that it's passed due, and I am confident that the committee will agree with that once you've heard about it. So House Bill 2700 contains two very important provisions, and they have been called by different names at different times in their history, but essentially the first one we call most commonly contraceptive equity, and it's a very simple idea that is really about basic fairness. We know that contraception is basic health care for women, but far too many insurance policies are failing to cover birth control the way they do any other basic service. So what the bill calls for is that if you have prescription drug coverage in your health care, that it needs to cover prescription birth control the same way it does any other prescription. And this has been something that we think really results in much higher costs to women and therefore to their families for the failure to provide this coverage. We know that approximately half of all insurance plans do not include this, and we think it's past time to correct that. So we call it a prescription for fairness because that's exactly what we think it is. Health plans shouldn't exclude prescription birth control. The second provision, and also extremely important, deals with emergency contraception in the emergency room. And what this part calls for is that for victims of rape and sexual assault who end up in an emergency room, we believe they should be afforded the opportunity to take advantage of emergency contraception right then and there. We don't think that we want to have rape victims, in addition to the tragedy that has already befallen them, out on the streets looking for a drugstore that's open with a prescription in hand in order to be taken in order to take advantage of something that they really need right at that time. Nothing in the bill says that they are required to make use of it, but they simply need to be told about it and then given the opportunity to actually get the prescription filled right there in the emergency room. And emergency contraception, as you probably know, is something that's extremely important to be used within 72 hours after an unintended pregnancy might have resulted. Almost one in six women are going to be victims of sexual assault in their lifetime, so this is something that potentially affects a great many women in our state. We know that more than half of the pregnancies in the United States are unintended, and half of all unintended pregnancies end in abortion. And so this bill can do something that, whether you're pro-choice or pro-life, you can agree on, which is to prevent the need for abortion by simply making birth control more readily available so that we don't need to get to that point. This is a bill that, in one form or another, has now passed 26 other states during the time that we have been working on this in Oregon. When this bill was in the House of Representatives a few weeks ago, I was pleased to co-carry it with Representative Tomei, who chaired the committee from which it came, and the bill passed overwhelmingly. In fact, the vote in the House was 49-9. So it's clear that this bill has broad bipartisan support. There is no doubt, and I'm sure you will hear from them shortly, that the women of Oregon are crying out for us to join those 26 other states and pass this bill. I hope you will be able to do so speedily, and I thank you very much for the opportunity to testify and for holding this long overdue hearing on, not long overdue in your committee, but long overdue in our state on House Bill 2700. Pleased to be here and happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Why don't we have Senator Brown testify also, and then...
Good morning, Madam Chair, Senator Gordley. Nice to see both of you this morning. For the record, State Senator Kate Brown represents Senate District 21. I am Diane's senator, or she's my House member. Thanks so much for hearing this bill. I believe that I introduced the first contraceptive equity bill in 1993. It was a product of the Oregon Women's Health and Wellness Act package. We have thought it would be an easy sell. Since it's many years later, it obviously was not such an easy sell. But I wanted to share one story with the committee. As this committee may remember, in the, must have been 96, 97, I think there was a little pill that came out about that time frame, and that pill was called Viagra. And this committee might recall that insurance companies covered Viagra, and I thought that was going to be our leap forward, that if insurance companies were covering Viagra, it would be very easy for us to get birth control covered. Well, unfortunately, I do believe because of the high cost of Viagra, it was a huge portion of pharmaceutical costs, close to 10%, the insurance companies stopped covering Viagra. So I think we lost the battle and won the war. So in any event, I'm glad that in 2007 that this body is able to move forward on this legislation. I appreciate your support, and it is way long overdue. Thank you, and I'm certainly happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Good morning to both of you. And we'd just like to thank you both, acknowledge and honor your leadership over these many years, and particularly to my colleague, Senator Brown, who's worked on this issue faithfully for well over 14 years. Well over 14 years. I do have a question for you. Have we had testimony on the House side from the Commission for Women?
You know, I didn't, Madam Chair and Senator Gordley, I do not serve on the committee that heard it. I know that there were many groups that testified. I honestly couldn't tell you if the Commission for Women was one of them. My own legislative assistant actually serves on the commission, so I can definitely find that out and get back to you.
I asked the question just acknowledging that that too is an important voice in our process. And just want to ensure that they've had the opportunity.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I agree with you. In fact, I served as chair of the Commission for Women, and I think it is an extremely important part of our government. I know that they have been without an executive director for a while, so that may have been somewhat limiting to their ability to participate, but we will definitely find out.
And I appreciate that you made that particular point about the commission's possible inability to participate in the process, because their role has been so diminished along with the other commissions. Ideally, the advocacy commissions, including the Commission for Women, are in statute and a part of our should be part of the structure that advises the legislature and the executive branch on making public policy. So again, I'm planting that seed and just putting that reminder out to all of us that that's another fight that we all need to continue to fight, so we restore those commissions to their proper place, their proper role.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I think I can say at least my office is very committed to making sure that happens, and I know that you have a number of senators willing to work to make that happen this session.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd
like to call Richard Thorne from Deschutes County, Carolyn Wendell from Marion County, and Linda Love, if you could all come forward. Who wants to go first?
I can.
All right.
Okay.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Linda Love, and I'm representing the Pro-Choice Coalition of Oregon. We are an extensive coalition that includes NARAL, Pro-Choice Oregon, Planned Parenthood, ACLU, and many others. We represent well over 100,000 Oregon women. I'm here today to urge the committee to take action on House Bill 2700, the Access to Birth Control Act. I'd like to address the two components of the bill, as Representative Rosenbaum just did, but to say a couple more things about them. First, the contraceptive equity portion of House Bill 2700 would correct the discriminatory practices and the insurance coverage by helping prevent unintended pregnancies in Oregon by requiring health insurance plans to cover prescription contraception if they cover prescription drugs. Approximately one-third of Oregon women with health insurance report that their insurance policy does not include contraceptive coverage. And contraceptive equity legislation like House Bill 2700 will not only increase access to birth control, but increase access to the method that best fits the woman's personal health concerns and lifestyle and effectively preventing unintended pregnancies. More than 45% of unintended pregnancies in Oregon occur in women who were not using contraception when they conceived, and of these women, 55% say that they would have used a birth control method if they had had access through their insurance. Oregon needs to join the 26 other states that have already passed the contraceptive equity legislation. The second component of the Access to Birth Control Act addresses the compelling issue of ensuring access to information about emergency contraception to victims of sexual assault. Emergency contraception is comprised of the same hormones used in common birth control pills, just at a different dosage. And when it's taken within 72 hours, emergency contraception can reduce the risk of unintended pregnancy by 89%. And if taken within 24 hours, reduces the risk of unintended pregnancy by 95%. And according to statistics cited by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the National Center for Injury Prevention and Control, 17% of women reported experiencing an attempted or completed rape at some time in their life, one in six. Every year, over 32,000 women become pregnant as a result of sexual assault. 32,000 unintended pregnancies. Providing basic health care by offering emergency contraception in the hospital to the victims of sexual assault will keep women from undergoing the additional trauma of an unintended pregnancy. We should do everything possible to minimize the trauma that sexual assault victims endure, and providing information and access to emergency contraception in the hospital for those who want it is necessary to provide for the optimal care and treatment of victims of sexual assault. For these reasons, I ask on behalf of thousands of Oregon women that you support House Bill 2700, the Access to Birth Control Act, and I thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you so much for coming.
I'm Dr. Richard Thorne. I practiced in Salem for 20 years and before that 9 years in Albany as an OBGYN specialist in infertility. I've taken care of women throughout my training and residency and internship in Los Angeles at USC LA County Medical Center and 2 years in the service before I came to Oregon. I have all my life been an advocate for women. And having said that, I think that I'm here to bring hopefully a moment of truth to this whole thing about emergency contraception. Time does not permit me to go through the entire House Bill 2700, but I'd like to just talk on three things. One, the so-called effectiveness or the efficiency of emergency contraceptive as quoted by those who are promoting this bill. Number two, speak a little bit about the conscience clause and what that might happen in as far as freedom of speech and objection to either performing of abortions or giving medication that may, depending on the time of the cycle, actually promote an abortion. I'm concerned when I read the bill that they say that it is the duty of the hospital to give, quotes, objective information, medically sounded and examined by peer review and by organizations such as the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, who in the bill are quoted as being not only authoritative source, but an objective source. And I will tell you, as a fellow of the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, I find that to be false, and I will tell you why. I have gave you in front, this comes from Contemporary OBGYN last month. This is a patient handout for doctors, general practitioners, and OBGYN, and nurse practitioners, etc., to give to women as far as information on emergency contraception. If you look at the first question, what is emergency contraception? They define it as far as its mechanism of action, that it prevents pregnancy mainly by stopping the release of an egg from an ovary and may also work by preventing a fertilized egg from attaching to the uterus or womb. Now, most of you are not embryologists, but every single embryology text states that life begins at fertilization. The American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology and many other societies that are different in their political aims have chosen to leave out medical science and change that pregnancy begins when implantation is well implanted, so that the morality or the functionality or its origins of the pre-implanted embryo is taken as a non-moral issue. Regardless of that, the embryonic textbooks have stated equivocally that at fertilization, a new life begins. And I quote just one. Dr. Keith Moore's book, The Developing Human, Clinically Oriented Embryology, 6th edition, says, quotes, ovarian hormones taken in doses within 72 hours after sexual intercourse usually prevent implantation of the blastocyst, or early embryo, probably by altering tubal motility, that's the movement of the fallopian tube, as it brings its passenger down into the uterus, interfering with ovarian transport or support, and causing abnormal changes in the lining of the uterus. These hormones prevent implantation, not fertilization. Consequently, they should not be called contraceptive pills. Conception occurs, but the blastocyst does not implant. Because the term abortion refers to a premature stoppage of pregnancy, the term abortion should be applied to such an early termination of pregnancy. The proponents of emergency contraceptive, of course, have inundated and indoctrinated state legislators in 26 states already. My own society that I belong to, the American College, has now become not an objective source of scientific information, but is sided with a political position of when life begins as opposed to scientific fact. The second thing I'd like to say is, how effective is it? We've heard from speakers anywhere from 89% to 95% effective. And the earlier you take it after intercourse, the better chance it has. There are now 5 studies starting in 2005 that refute in peer review literature Obstetrics and Gynecology, the American Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology, the British Journal of Obstetrics, that state, lo and behold, despite their expectations that pregnancies unintended would be decreased by 50%, and therefore abortion would be decreased anywhere, the figures are from 50,000 in the United States to over 500,000 abortions would be decreased, has not come to fruition. Dr. Trussell, a PhD from North Carolina, in 1994 stated, with the usage of emergency contraception, we will half the unintended pregnancies and half the unintended abortions that come from that result. Dr. Trussell, in 2007, January issue of Obstetrics and Gynecology, said, we have now found in 23 studies from 10 countries involving over 35,000 women, the pregnancy rate and abortion rate has not been changed by the use of emergency contraception. He was honest enough to say in a peer review literature that he scratched his head and said, my gosh, why are we not seeing this reduction? And he gives various reasons. His conclusion, after saying that emergency contraception fails to do what it was intended to do, which is to reduce unintended pregnancy, in all the studies shown, all he can say is it may have an indirect effect on our society in helping women not have an unintended pregnancy by making them better usage of using the contraceptive method that they presently use. So that its only advantage that emergency contraception may provide women is that they might use the OCs better and not forget them, or make sure that the condoms are the best kind of condoms that don't break during intercourse.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I have a question for it's Dr. Thorne.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to ask this question. A woman, and I'm speaking from my experience as a person who worked as a volunteer rape victim advocate, working with rape victims,
mm-hmm.
Walking through them through the process of being interviewed by the police and sitting with them through exams in a hospital. And this is my question. Should emergency contraception be available to a rape victim in the emergency room?
That's
a woman who has been raped. Should it be available?
That's an excellent question. The question I would say is, should it be available to all hospitals, and including those hospitals with a religious belief that believe in their own way that in certain cases, depending on the time of the cycle that the emergency contraceptive is given, that it can work as an abortifacient. That would be contrary to the conscience of that particular hospital. For those hospitals that do not have that conscience, then I think emergency contraception should be available in the emergency rooms. We're not here to prevent. I've been a health care advocate for women for 30 years. I'm here to protect women. The problem I find is that over the last 5 years I've studied emergency contraception along with medical abortion, is that women have not been told the entire truth. Even the FDA panel, 24-3, that advised the FDA to allow the OTC usage of emergency contraception, said in their recommendations, please put in the brochure that you give the women that in some of the times it may cause abortion, depending on the cycle. The FDA advisory panel suggested that, and it was ignored. They gave, and they took this off the top of their hat, that 10% of the time it may work as an abortifacient. It's impossible to say. You can play the number games all you want. But basically, for lay people, it can act as preventing implantation depending when it's given in the cycle. If it happens before ovulation, then its primary effect is contraceptive. If it happens during or within hours of ovulation, it hasn't prevented ovulation, therefore its effect is a direct removal of that pre-implantation embryo. And that was not... So the last study I want to say just came out in February from England. Now, all the studies so far
And you'll need to hurry in.
How much time do I have?
Well, every person should take about 5 minutes, and
okay.
You've taken 10.
I know. I'm sorry. Well, it's a big thing, and I know I'm David and Goliath here. I'm not here to... Okay. I would say the last report in February came from Britain. Now, so far, I've said that no studies have shown that emergency contraceptive, when looked by people that have promoted emergency contraceptive, has shown it to reduce pregnancy or abortion. That is medical fact, and it's substantiated by the bibliography I gave you. The last one came from Britain in this February. They found that despite the marketing of oral contraceptives and EC, therapeutic abortions increased. First study to show it. They increased. So EC has been promoted to decrease the plight of women, and it's having an opposite effect, particularly in England. Not only in teens who don't have their marbles altogether, according to our society, but women in their 20s and 30s in quotes, long-term stable relationships, women that you know better. They're committed to using their contraceptive in the most effective way. Older women were thought to afford, comply, and understand contraceptive usage than a 14-year-old teen. Results, almost 50% of women who became pregnant were not using birth control, forgot to take the pills, or did not use emergency contraceptive, even when it was given to them free and placed in their medicine cabinet at home. The increased use of therapeutic abortion as a form of birth control in England is increasing. 20% have an abortion if not using birth control. Repeat therapeutic abortion has approaching 50% in England. 188,000 women in the UK have a therapeutic abortion each year. All ages have repeat abortions, sometimes up to 3 to 4. And their conclusion, I'll end with this, is by Dr. Dawn Harper. Why isn't emergency contraception working? Her answer is, as a health specialist for women, must promote more contraception. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Fine. Hello. Hello, Chair Mona Sanderson and committee. My name is Carolyn Wendell, and I've got my story to tell. I am against Senate Bill 2700. In 1966, two friends and I were the victims of rape by what turned out to be three serial rapists. We were robbed and then we were beaten. We were robbed and raped one by one. I was beaten when I tried to escape and get help. We all still suffer the emotional and physical scars in varying ways. Sorry. To this very day. I would ask that you amend 2700 as written, to state that any woman who goes to a hospital because of rape was actually raped. This is so she can get help and go through and get the men off the streets. Also counseling. In my observation of this bill, the monies are being asked for in subsequent House bills provide taxpayers funding to train nurses, but they do not pay money to get counseling. We have to make certain that the numbers of rapes, the actual penetrations that cause rapes, that could lead to pregnancy, are diminished and get the bad guys off the street. As teenagers, my friends and I made the decision to get the police involved. We were 18 at the time. There was no setup for rape victims then. We were on our own. We went through months of lineups behind two-way mirrors, police stations. I'm sorry. Depositions, police artists, and the trial. We did get the bad guys off the streets to save other women reporting this made it work. Most women won't have to go through what we did, but it's worth it to stop the violence from those three men. The pain will always be with us, but we did something positive. Thank you, Senator. Please amend House Bill 2700 so that sexual assaults mean actual rape, and then have the hospitals get the legal authorities involved, like they do with minors, so that this will help future women. Thank you very much.
I so appreciate your testimony.
I'm sorry.
And it takes it's very courageous for you to come here and
thank
share
you.
That story. And this body has been addressing several domestic violence and sexual assault
right.
bills. And I'm we are definitely going to look at your need that you see for counseling for rape victims. So
and my thing also is that I just don't want a cavalier kind of thing going in with girls saying that they were raped if they weren't. If they were raped, get the guys, get rid of them, put them away so they can't do this to other people. We're still suffering after 41 years mm-hmm. in varying ways, and I thank you so much.
Thank you very, very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Jenny Hawkins, Teresa Ferrero, and Ariel Smith.
Good morning. My name is Teresa Guerrero. I am the interim executive director from the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. And the coalition has been in existence for the last about 30 years, and we've been in existence since 1978. We were established as a statewide support network for domestic violence and rape crisis centers throughout the state of Oregon. And I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2700, but in particular to address the provision of a bill that provides for greater access to emergency contraception for survivors of sexual assault. As many of you know, and as has been mentioned here, 1 in 6 women have experienced sexual violence in their lifetime. And rape, like other forms of sexual violence, is a violation of bodily integrity, autonomy, and sense of self. The experience erodes a woman's sense of trust and safety. Recovery from the trauma is a process that can take weeks, months, and sometimes even years. Often a woman knows her attacker and must deal with them afterwards in the office, neighborhood, or even their home. Many women fear subsequent attacks and other retaliation if they report the crime. As a result of rape, some women may be physically injured, become pregnant, or contract a venereal disease like HIV. Survivors of sexual assault deserve proper care, and often the first place to go to is the hospital emergency room. Informing a patient about and dispensing emergency contraception in the hospital emergency rooms offers a safe option for sexual assault victims. With access to the complete information about a treatment option such as emergency contraception, victims of sexual assault would be empowered to make the best decisions for their lives and begin the process of rebuilding their lives one decision at a time. And House Bill 2700 is about victims' rights and victims' lives. I urge you to support this bill. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jenny Hawkins, and I am pleased to testify before you today in support of House Bill 2700. I'm a self-employed human resources consultant and purchase my own health insurance through Regions Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon, specifically the Premier Selections Policy, which covers prescriptions but not prescription contraceptives. I was surprised recently when I went to the pharmacy to fill a cosmetic prescription for a skin whitener to whiten areas darkened by sun damage. And I assumed it would not be covered because it was a cosmetic prescription, but the pharmacist informed me that the skin whitener was covered. I was appalled that this cosmetic prescription was covered, but something as basic as birth control was not covered. I contacted Regions Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon about upgrading my plan to one that covers contraceptives. I learned that I already had the most expensive and comprehensive policy and that none of their policies available to individuals cover contraceptives. I also checked with my independent insurance agent and a State Farm agent and learned that, again, there were no individual policies that I could purchase that covered contraceptions. I'm more than willing to pay a premium for a plan that covers the only regular prescription I use, but could not find a reputable, well-known company that offered contraceptive coverage to Oregonians like myself who are self-employed and purchase our own health care insurance. I'm not ready to start a family and therefore am forced to pay out of pocket for the basic health care prescription. I also spoke with a college friend who, like me, is a self-employed business owner and a Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon insurance customer. She takes a hormone prescription to treat a hormone condition and its painful symptoms. Her prescription is not used for contraceptive purposes, but to treat her medical condition. Still, it is not covered by her policy because the same product is generally used for contraceptive purposes. Isolating one particular group of prescriptions, contraceptives, from the regular prescription coverage, even when they are prescribed to treat a medical condition, such as a hormone imbalance, just doesn't make sense. I urge you to change this inequity and support House Bill 2700. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Ms. Hawkins. Questions?
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and ladies and gentlemen. For the record, my name is Ariel Smits, and I'm a family physician who's pleased to come here to testify in support of this bill and in support of the women whose lives have been noticeably improved by passage of this legislation. I want to focus on three aspects of this bill today. The first is equity, that contraceptives should be covered in the same way as other drugs in a health policy. The second is women's health. Contraceptives are good for women's health because pregnancy and childbirth still carry some risks. And lastly, I want to talk about the benefit to children. Children who are born from planned pregnancies have better educational outcomes and better long-term success in life than those born to unplanned pregnancies. The first issue is equity. Contraceptive drugs and devices should be treated equally to all other drugs and devices with a given prescription drug plan. Treating these drugs differently for medications for things like high blood pressure is inconsistent with the public health policies that have guided Oregon health services and insurance for years. It's good public policy to ensure that women, particularly those with lower incomes, have access to reliable contraception without barriers such as from having to pay for these medications, just as all people have access to cholesterol medications or treatments to depression if that's covered by their health plans. Contraception has been long known to improve health outcomes and have substantial economic benefits for families, businesses, and communities. The second issue I want to talk about is women's health. Despite substantial advances in medical care, there still is a risk to pregnancy. About 17 women out of every 100,000 will die from a pregnancy-related event, either from preeclampsia, infections from cesarean sections, hemorrhage, or other reasons. A recent study over 20 years in Great Britain showed that the relative risk for death among women who were taking oral contraceptives was actually lower than those among women who were not. Denying equal access to contraception puts women at risk of morbidity and mortality associated with pregnancy. In addition, oral contraceptives can be used to treat other women's health conditions, such as endometriosis, abnormal bleeding, ovarian cysts, and other conditions. Easy access to contraception would ensure that women's health problems would be easily treatable. Easy access to contraception, like the pill, would ensure that women's health issues are addressed. And finally, we must think about the children of Oregon. Studies have shown that children who are born from unintended pregnancy are more likely to live in poverty, more likely to have lack appropriate access to health care, are less likely to complete education, and less likely to have good employment than those children who are born from planned pregnancies. Babies who are born from unplanned pregnancies are more likely to be born prematurely and have had their mothers are more likely to have had inadequate prenatal care. Such babies suffer lifelong medical consequences, which cost our society substantial dollars that could be used for other preventive services. In summary, contraceptive equity is good public policy. It's in women and children's interests and is fiscally sound policy. I want to thank you for letting me address you today, and thank you for your consideration of these issues.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I have a question for Ms. Guerrero. Good morning again to you. And you're new in the role at the Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence.
I'm the interim executive director.
I just wanted to welcome you into that role.
Thanks.
And say to you if there's anything that we can do to support you in your role and in your leadership, please call on us. It's delightful to see a woman of color in your role and also involved in this movement for fairness and equity. Thank you.
And also to share with us needs that you see in dealing with rape victims. I think it's extremely important due to the testimony we heard earlier that that's an area we need to be focusing on also.
Any other questions?
Just a comment. I really, even as a lawmaker for 22 years, I'm shocked. I thought that this was already possible. I thought contraceptives were already a part of insurance carriers' benefits. And I'm absolutely shocked that in 2007 we're still looking at legislation of this nature. My position is shame on those of us who've not done anything about it, because we put women in binds all the time. We fuss about those low-income women who are on welfare and they have to get human services. And then we don't want to give you contraceptions or allow you to have them at a lower cost. And then we don't feed the babies when they go to school because we say it costs too much. And then when a woman decides to have an abortion, we say that that's wrong, it's sinful, and you shouldn't do it. And no wonder many women are paranoid in this country, simply because we don't want to do the right thing. And yes, we can go on with our moralizing all day long and say, well, you shouldn't have sex till you get married. Give me a break. You know, this is absolutely unbelievable, and I'm absolutely shocked as a lawmaker that in 2007 we're still doing this kind of stuff. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Further comments? I see Representative Clem here, so we'll call him up. Thank you, panel, very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Brian Clem, State Representative from here in the Salem area, and I will be fairly brief. I just had one item that in some conversations with constituents of mine I wanted to clarify for the record. It turned out, I've just learned, it actually came up in the House Committee too, and so it's sort of on the record over there as well, but I thought I would just do it here because I didn't do as much of my homework until this morning as I should have. And the question basically has to do with when someone presents themselves in an ER as a victim of sexual assault and the doctor is looking at the situation and has deemed that the activity that they described occurring to them could not have resulted in pregnancy, for example, you know, sodomy or some other kind of assault that didn't involve intercourse. The way that it was answered in the House Committee, and I just wanted to get it out here too, the section of the law that deals with medically contraindication, the doctor would not offer them emergency contraception when there was no risk of pregnancy. And just that's the way the doctor answered it in our committee. I know you've had some folks here on that same point, but I just wanted to clarify again that we would not be offering people, and doctors would not be offering people, emergency contraception when there's no risk of pregnancy under the section of the law that talks about medically contraindicated, and that's what that means.
Thank you. I assume that that is a medical prerogative, and I would assume every physician would follow that standard.
Good. Okay.
Thank you, Representative Clinton. Okay. Ronell Shanko, Alice Bartlett, and Kathy Eaton.
Good I'll go first. My name is Alice Bartelt, and I'm here representing the 2,000 members of the American Association of University Women of Oregon. And I don't want to become repetitious, but we ask for your support for House Bill 2700. AUW has been very concerned with the fact that women make less than men do and on their jobs generally, and this extra $600 a month that many women have to pay for contraceptives just makes a larger burden on those women. So it's only fair then that they should be covered by insurance that cover other prescriptions. And, of course, we also support the having emergency contraceptives available in the emergency room. Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kathy Eaton. I'm the governance chair coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. We appreciate the opportunity to talk in favor of House Bill 2700, and the League has supported the rights of women and young women to have access to reproductive health care choices, which include insurance coverage for prescription contraception. And I certainly join with Senator Brown. We've been around a long time attempting to get this legislation passed, and we hope that this is the session that will see that to fruition. For too many legislative sessions, Oregon decision makers have denied reproductive health care access for women. We support both the fact that drug companies and health insurance providers would be necessitated of offering this to women. Alice Bartelt referred to the fact that it costs women about 68% more for their health care. And it's much of that is attributed to the fact that they don't have access to prescription drugs for contraception. We also feel that the emergency room access is very important. This is a traumatic time for women, and it should not be something that they have to press for or be sent out to try to seek after they've had a sexual assault. So we believe that this bill, its time has come, and we urge you to pass it forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Eaton.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Ronelle Schenkel with the Attorney General's Office. I'm here today specifically testifying on behalf of the Sexual Assault Task Force, and the testimony that you actually have before you is from Heather Hutanen, the training director of the task force. She wasn't able to join us, so I'm presenting her information today. For those of you that don't know, in 1999, the Attorney General worked together and responded to the victim or advocates for victims of sexual assault, law enforcement, prosecutors and agency persons who were interested in coming together to deal with the issues surrounding sexual assault. The task force is currently comprised of more than 225 appointed and volunteer members statewide from a wide variety of backgrounds. Our task force has a legislative public policy committee, which the Attorney General sits on himself, and that is the group that has looked at this bill. The mission of the task force is not directly on point with the entirety of this bill, so we are neutral on the bill itself. However, we're here today specifically to talk about the emergency contraceptive sections of the bill. In order to be brief, and because you have written testimony from Heather with a lot of the statistics and references to reports, I will not go through all of that in detail. You've heard many of the statistics today. We agree and support with the information you have already been provided. I will just say that the task force does unequivocally support the provisions of the bill related to emergency contraceptive. It is an important part of the services that go to the victims of sexual assault. We believe that administering emergency contraceptions in the aftermath of sexual assault is in order and in avoiding negative after negative pregnancy tests is a standard component of both the national and the local state level medical protocol and guidelines, and you have some information in the testimony about that. We feel strongly that all victims of sexual assault deserve consistent professional care with access to the full range of options. This includes emergency contraception as one option, and so we urge the support.
Comment. Thank you very, very much. Marcia Kelly and Catherine Bradley. And this one.
Thank you, Chair Monna Sanderson and members of the committee. My name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm testifying today for the Women's Rights Coalition. The Women's Rights Coalition formed to support the Equal Rights Amendment in the mid-70s, and we have been on record as supporting contraceptive equity and emergency contraception since they were introduced. I won't add too much more than that. It's important for women to be able to have contraception so that they can plan their families and in a manner that will allow them to follow either their professional or family life in the most appropriate manner. And we feel that contraception in many of the hospitals as for emergency contraception as a result of sexual assault or rape is very vital, and the access is very vital in the hospitals. The concern that we have is in rural hospitals, you only have one, and so we want to make sure that that access in the hospital is there. Hospitals are not individuals, and they should not have the ability to have a conscience. Individual providers in the hospital might have the ability to have a conscience, but the hospital itself is not an individual, and it doesn't have a right to say something. And the concern that we have is especially in the rural areas where you may only have one provider as a place to go for a result of rape. So that's something that I would be very concerned about in any tweaking of the bill to any more extent.
Thank you. Thank you. Questions?
Chair Monna Sanderson and committee, my name is Catherine Bradley, Administrator for the Office of Family Health, and I am speaking for the office. Dr. Higginson, who was originally going to speak for the department, is ill today and not able to attend. We are speaking in support of House Bill 2700, and I will just hit a couple of high points on our testimony since much of the information has been covered by previous speakers. I do want to reiterate the importance of this bill in terms of providing coverage for prescriptive birth control. About two-thirds of insured women in Oregon do not currently have coverage for prescriptive contraceptives, according to the most recent available data to our department. And before states started to require prescriptive contraceptive coverage, women paid about 70% more out of pocket, and I think you've heard very detailed testimony in regards to that earlier today, but that 70% number is still what we consider to be an out-of-pocket average. The third point I wanted to make was when coverage for prescriptive contraceptions was added to the Federal Employees Health Benefit Program, the Office of Personnel Management reported there was no cost increase associated with that change, so we do think it's an appropriate financial burden in terms of an impact on the insurance companies. In relation to the second part of this bill, which does speak to the importance of hospitals providing sexual assault victims with information about emergency contraception, I want to bring your attention to a study that the department did in 2003. In our DHS Reproductive Health Program, we conducted a study of the availability of emergency contraceptives in Oregon's hospital emergency departments. And what we found was that only 60% of our emergency departments routinely offered emergency contraceptive to victims at rape at that time. Among those departments that did offer emergency contraceptives, almost half did not provide it on-site, but instead gave victims a prescription to be filled at an outside pharmacy. And emergency departments that had staff with specialized sexual assault training or that had written rape protocols requiring EC to be offered were more likely to offer EC routinely in cases of rape. And we think that the study really does emphasize the importance of having the hospitals have a requirement, because if they build policies and procedures into place, there is a higher likelihood that that will be followed. It needs to be the hospital. The other component of that is having the availability there on site, because we think it's an undue requirement to actually hand someone a prescription and then ask that they find that information in another location. So those were the two aspects of that study that we thought were extremely important.
Do you think that this bill will actually require hospitals to have protocols to implement this?
It would be our assumption that if the hospital is required, that the hospital then to protect itself would normally put policies and procedures into place. Yes, Chair. Melissa Anderson. Just the final note is, from the review of the department's healthcare licensing and certification program, all the activities that are required within this bill are considered to be appropriate work. And it does have a relatively small fiscal impact of approximately $25,000 per biennium. It is important to note this funding was not included in the governor's recommended budget. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? All right. John, is it Charles and Sherry? A-O-C-K-E-R. Crocker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Charles, president of Cascade Policy Institute, a nonprofit research center in Portland. My comments will be brief. I'd like to focus on conflicts between Sections 1 and Section 3 that you may wish to consider. Section 1 in Lines 5, 6, and 7 make a wonderful statement about the right to freedom from unreasonable government intrusion of people into their private lives, specifically the right of consenting individuals to obtain and use methods of contraception without interference by governmental entities. That's great. Couldn't have done better myself. Wish that kind of policy statement appeared more often in bills. Lines 14, 15, and 16 then proceed to impose a government mandate, which is exactly the opposite concept. So it seems like you could have one of those sections proceed, but having them both in the same bill makes the bill inherently have a policy conflict. Second point I'd like to make is that every time you add a mandate to insurance, at the margin you increase the cost. Oregon already has approximately 31 health insurance mandates. There are probably 4, 5, or 6 still pending in capital, and my comment is the same on all of them. If you had another mandate and restrict the ability of people to negotiate policies that are best suited for them, then the total cost rises, and therefore the availability of lower cost insurance shrinks, and some people are going to get bumped out of the pool of people who can even get coverage. And I guess my third and final point is that, especially when you add predictable prospective expenses like contraception, then you've clearly moved from health insurance to something else that might be called prepaid health care, which cannot be provided cheaply. The only way you can provide insurance cheaply is by a pooled risk program in which you insure for things you hope never actually happen. The best insurance programs, whether home, auto, or life, are those which you pay modest premiums and hopefully you never actually use any of them. When you start insuring for things that are desirable, and predictable on a monthly basis, then the cash flow requirements for the companies must go up and someone has to pay, and that's going to be all policyholders. So basically, if this bill passes, there will clearly be, in economic terms, winners, but there will also be losers. And my guess is the losers will be those with the lowest levels of skill, the lowest levels of income, for whom employers will find it least favorable to insure. So I think you should just be aware that there are not only policy conflicts within the bill, but it puts you in the process of sort of inadvertently picking winners and losers, and you should just be aware of those trade-offs. I personally would prefer to see a more market-driven, consumer-driven approach, and this moves us in the opposite direction. Thank you.
Thank you. And I know that cost containment is an extremely important issue for this body, and we have been looking at health care reform, and hopefully at some point in time we will have everyone covered by health insurance and hopefully be able to address those cost containment factors when we have health care reform. But thank you very much for your testimony.
Hello, my name is Sherry Crocker, and I live in Salem, Oregon. And the only other thing I was going to say about myself is that I do work in two pregnancy support centers here in Salem, and also I'm on the board of a foundation that has three homes for women who have chosen to keep their children no matter what the circumstances. And a lot of these young girls that stay in these homes have probably been through some of the worst experiences anybody could want, and at a very young age. Sometimes they are only 14, 15 years old. And, you know, it could be from family members, it could be from boyfriends, but they are left with nobody to take care of them, and these three homes are always available for these young women. And I know there's other homes out there too, so, you know, there are people that are very supportive of young women who find themselves pregnant. I have lots of trouble with this bill. I am very much against it. I tried to go through it three or four times in the last 3 weeks and tried to write up some of the biggest glaring problems with it. So I just gave you each a sheet of copy. The main thing for me is that when we see the women at the pregnancy support centers, and they have come to us and said they've taken contraceptives and now are pregnant, and then they say they have side effects from these contraceptives. We had, and I'll just give two examples, a young girl, probably 16 years old. She had just been given Depo-Provera, and she had been bleeding for a month, and she could not get any doctor or anyone to stop her bleeding. And she came to us and said, can you help us? So we called the doctors we knew in the area, and they tried to work with her. They invited her to come to their office, and they just saw her. They didn't charge her anything. Another couple came in, a husband and wife. They were given or asked for RU-486. The woman took the first part of it, and then you're supposed to wait a few days before you take the second part. And she came to us before she took the second part and said, I don't want to do this anymore. And now I'm sick all the time, and I don't know what to do. And so these contraceptives are killing the babies. And we don't want these contraceptives in our Catholic hospitals. We don't want them in our Catholic support centers. We don't want them in our Catholic or Christian social services. We want that part of the bill beefed up a lot, so that if we have a moral conscience against contraceptives, which kill babies, that should be stronger. And I'm not sure which paragraph that's in. I think it's the section 3-4. It just says religious employer. But the way we read that, then the Catholic hospitals would have to give this. St. Vincent de Paul thrift store would have to give this to their employees or anybody that the insurance policy said they had to give it to. I I think in some cases they're just inaccuracies, and I'm not a doctor. I don't know. I wish the doctor was still here, but I just gave a little anecdotal thing that if my husband and I had intercourse and conceived a child, and then a few weeks later I was raped, it says that this would not interfere with the pregnancy. It would certainly interfere with the pregnancy. Every one of these contraceptives ruins the lining of the uterus. It takes the blood away. That baby, the legitimate baby, would have been killed by these contraceptives. If I had been raped and I was in the hospital and I was emotional and I didn't know what I was doing and my husband couldn't get there right then, who knows what these doctors would have said to me. I don't need that kind of counseling then. I need counseling for the rape, for the crime committed against me. So I want to see stronger language in here about helping women, counseling them. You're missing the point on this bill completely, and that's why it's failed for 14 years. You are not helping women. You're not helping babies. You are killing babies, and you are damaging women with these drugs. And I've got lots of literature. All these literatures need to be in the hands of anyone in hospitals. They all say this, what I'm saying to you now. And somebody's been putting out some really bad literature. I've gone into some of these clinics where they're trying to encourage women to use these contraceptives, and they say nothing about the lining of the uterus. They say nothing about abortion. They say all these chemicals are great. I wouldn't want to give these chemicals to my son, let alone to any of my daughters. Thank you very much.
Appreciate your testimony. Thank you for coming. And I do know that any drug has some side effects, but there are so these drugs have also saved many, many, many lives. Joel Ario, I'd like you to come up, and then Nancy Nevins, please come up. Regarding the religious exemption that Ms. Crocker referred to, I think it's in intent of the bill that if you look at the bill, do you have the bill in front of you?
Yes.
Yeah. On page 2, line 4, it says that a religious employer is exempt from the requirements of this section. And a religious employer to the health in rules, would you be able to, by rule, have state that a religious employer shall certify to the health benefit plan that it is an exempt, since that may be a difficulty for the health plans, for the hospital, the religious, for the health plans to determine if the if they're really a religious employer.
Madam Chair, for the record, Joel Ario, Insurance Administrator with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I believe we could handle this. I'm not even sure we need to do a rule. I think the people will come forward and say they're a religious employer, and if we have only a few of those kind of situations and no difficulty, I think it can just be handled in the marketplace. Were there to be an issue where insurers are stuck in the middle of having to make a determination like that, I don't think that's the intent of the bill, and I believe that we could work that problem out, and if we had to go to rule, we would go to rule and clarify the issue.
Thank you very much. Ms. Evans.
Hi. Madam Chair and committee members, I'm Nancy Nevins with LifeWise Health Plan of Oregon, and for the record, I'd like to state that all of our group health plans cover contraceptive management, and starting with our next renewal, all of our individual plans will also cover contraceptive management as an included benefit. And what we are, second part of what I would like to discuss today is that we would recommend some clarifying language to this bill to help health plans understand exactly what the intent and how to impacts their benefit design, specifically in Section 3, Sub 2, which would address the coverage requirements for health benefit plans, that we would have clarifying language to address that the other covered services would be subject to the cost shares that would be applicable to other categories of covered services. For example, if you have an office visit to receive the prescription for birth control pills, it's covered the same as other office visits. We think that section could benefit from some clarifying language. So that's what we would be requesting and recommending.
So, Mr. Ario, if a person gets a depo and that's considered an office visit,
mm-hmm. and an injection.
An injection. And if a person gets a Norplant and that's considered an office surgery,
mm-hmm.
or an IUD, same thing, office surgery, could it be made explicit in rules that those services would be covered?
Madam Chair, yes.
Because of the diagnostic?
Covered the same as other similar categories of services.
Madam Chair, yes, it could. Again, I'm not sure we even have to go to rule because I believe the language of 1B, which talks about all the ancillary services necessary to prescribe, dispense, deliver, distribute, administer, and remove prescription contraceptive would be picked up in the language of 2. But where they need to clarify it, we would clarify it along the lines of, I believe, the intent here, which is that any of those ancillary services would be covered under the same parity principle, if you want, that they would have to be covered the same way for contraceptive prescriptions as for any other drug, and they would be subject to the same limitations or conditions as those other drugs. So we think the language is workable. The amendment could be done if the committee chose to do it, but we think the current language is workable as well.
And the second part that we had talked about is what you just addressed in regards to the religious employer exemption and having the ability for the employer to certify to the health plan that they meet the requirements of it. And I believe that if we would have written documentation regarding the confirmation of that understanding, that would be very beneficial to the health plans and for, you know, as we go down the road, moving away from the legislation, make sure that we're all on the same page regarding the impact of the legislation.
Madam Chair, again, we believe we can do that, too. We don't think there needs to be new language in the bill to accomplish the purpose that the insurers do not, is not the intent of the bill for insurers to be stuck in the middle of trying to determine whether a claim by an employer to be a religious employer is valid or not. That's not the intent of the bill.
Thank you.
Thank
Further
you.
Discussion. I have no one else to testify. Okay, I'd like to close the public hearing, and I want to go into recess for about 5 minutes till we can get some other members to the in the Senate Committee on Health Policy and Public Affairs. And I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 2700. I did forget to mention to you, colleagues, Jim Anderson had submitted for the record testimony from the Oregon, the American College of Emergency Physicians. And then we have Wyeth submitted testimony, and Rejuvenation did, and what was this last one? This one was from Michelle Gooden from Bend, Oregon. So that is in the record. We're in work session, and I wanted to point out that there were a couple of concerns regarding making sure that similarly covered services was addressed, and we wanted to make sure that if a religious employer could be exempt, that they can certify to the health benefit plan that they are exempt. And we do not need legislation for this, according to the department, Joel Ario, and we want to make sure that that is continuous. This is on the record, and I just talked with Ms. Nevins, and we are definitely going to make sure that Joel Ario gets it on the record with HRAC. And so I think that we don't need to hold the bill up any longer. And with that, I would like to take a motion.
Madam Chair,
I move House Bill 2700A to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Carter moves House Bill 2700A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Yeah, Madam Chair.
Yes.
I'm in support of Section 5 of the bill, for victims of sexual assault. I think that's important and appropriate. I have problems with the rest of the bill, both from the mandate perspective, and I do think there are some language issues that I'm just not comfortable with, so I will not be supporting the bill.
Thank you. Any other discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Carter?
Hey.
Senator Courtney?
Yes.
Senator
Curry?
No. Senator Gordon?
Aye.
You're not Senator Gordon.
Oh. I'm just voting for her.
Wow. You're going to vote twice?
Senator Gordley is excused. Okay. Motion passed. And Senator Gordley and Senator Brown will be co-carrying this bill. With that, I close the work session on House Bill 2700, and we are adjourned.